にも作ろうし強く咲く大輪日頃より携わる力今こそ解き放て
From your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Sunday night, December 21st, 2025, as we record this new episode. It's the week of Christmas, and Hanukkah is ending on Monday, December 22nd, and the Chicago White Sox delivered a nice gift to their fans, perhaps what will be their biggest free agent signing this offseason. The White Sox agreed to a deal with Japanese power hitter Munetaki Murakami, their first Japanese free agent signing since Tadahito Oguchi back in 2005, and it comes at a reasonable cost of just 2 years and $34 million. Worth the risk for the White Sox of adding the 25-year-old who bashed 245 home runs in Japan since 2019, including 56 home runs in the 2022 season. But there might be a reason why the White Sox won the bid for Murakami, as there are significant red flags in his hitting profile. He also doesn't grade well defensively. So for a cash-strapped White Sox franchise, is Murakami worth the risk? That's the question we're going to try to answer in this episode. And joining me are Sox Machine's beat reporter, James Fegan, and managing editor, Jim Margulis. And hello, gentlemen. Again, 2 years, $34 million for Munetaki Murakami. He'll be wearing number 5. You can go to the White Sox team store and already buy his jersey, no matter what kind, home, away, alternative, city edition. They already got it on hand. They don't got Colson Montgomery jerseys, but they got Murakami jerseys already in stock. And the White Sox will have to pay a $6.575 million posting fee for Murakami. So overall, the cost of the White Sox is around $40 million. James Fegan, at the onset of the offseason, it just didn't appear, based on the predictions that other outlets made of what Murakami is asking for slash could sign for, that the White Sox would be serious suitors for Murakami. But here we are. The White Sox end up signing him. What was your initial reaction to the news?
Initial reaction? Oh, man, I'm supposed to be at the gym in a half hour. This is... This is going to get complicated fast. I had a lot scheduled Sunday.
That's a good one.
Like, it's down to the point, like, in terms of talent, in terms of, like, your depth chart for first base, what your other options realistically are, and probably equally erratic, and in some cases equally defensive flawed, but don't have this sort of ceiling. And as certainly what his value slipped to back, like, at the start of the offseason when people were predicting him potentially get triple digits, if some team really fell in love with, like, the raw power, it seems like a bargain, relatively. It only stands out that, well, the only question that kind of comes with the White Sox is that it slid into their price range, but is this going to be their big outlay? And thus, like, they have a finite level of big outlays. Is this your one, and it's the one that has probably a lot of variance? And, like, if this is your one shot at this level, certainly maybe this offseason, but yeah, I don't know how regularly they will pay people like over $15 million in free agency per year. Should they, the chances of getting like a one, like someone who's just not a two war player, like annually, or, you know, quickly, like, hey, this is just not going to translate. There's a lot of risk involved with that that maybe is underplayed when we talk about low risk signings every time it's like somebody who's on a short term deal or seemingly jettisoned without it being a years long thing. But if you're not taking that many shots, it is maybe a bit more risky than it implies just by looking at, like, hey, it's not like first base is going to get worse if he bottles out at this point.
Jim, how about you? What was your initial reaction to the news?
Cool. Not, you know, I would say super excited about the production possibilities just because of the amount of swing and miss in this game in NPB. And, you know, just listening to Anthony Kay talk about how nobody strikes out in Japan and how you have to tailor your entire approach to pitching around not chasing strikeouts. And then you have a guy who's nearly striking out 30% of the time, posting fantastic numbers around it. But you hear about, you know, velocity concerns and such, and it's, you know, dampened some enthusiasm. But, you know, the White Sox have not had a Japanese player since Kosuke Fukudome in 2012. You know, they had a neat little run with Shingo Takatsu and Tadahito Okuchi, and like we enjoyed the, you know, enjoyed the production, but also like the I guess the cultural exchange of it all, the novelty. And, you know, then to go 13 years without it, and, you know, not have any of the stories or the interest, or just, you know, I'm looking forward to what James encounters, just with the amount of media that shows up at White Sox games, and you know how different that is, given that the beat has shrunk, and like they haven't been worth following. So like there's a surge of interest, and it is probably pound for pound or dollar for dollar like the most interesting move they could make, and it leverages like their, you know, what they had to offer, which is playing time at first base and no real impact if he busts. The thing that jumped out to me was, you know, reading Fangraphs and Michael Bauman talking about the 73.4% contact rate. And like, that was Colson Montgomery's territory right before he got the torpedo bat. So is it that simple? Just give him a different shaped barrel and all of a sudden he's fixed, and his problems will be now just like whiffing and everything outside the zone. I don't know if the White Sox are, it's a situation where the White Sox were lowballing, thinking, oh, we'll never get our offer accepted. And like, holy crap, we won the auction. We didn't intend to pay this. Like, imagine at that price, there's like, hey, this guy's interesting. The power's legit. Let's see if we can make it happen. And you know, if it doesn't work for 3 months and it clicks, like the White Sox can afford that because they have no immediate expectations. Like, this is the best possible use of the unlimited runway they have. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens.
To expound upon something I thought while Jim was talking, to improve upon my initial blank of initial reaction, I think the White Sox are more and more like trying to form themselves as an organization that develops talent or like feels confident handing people to Brian Fuller's operation, or simply needs to survive that way, where they're producing their own guys in house a lot more because they don't usually have the money for these sorts of swings. That sort of approach, especially like working the waiver wire as much as they do, you're not going to get upon like your hands on like a lot of 80 tools. So I think from them, this feels like a scarcity of opportunity that's worth it to be like, well, we're not going to get anyone like the, obviously Wolko's in the system, but as far as like near major league ready, or obviously going to go straight in the majors with this sort of juice, like they're not going to really produce that internally anytime soon. So if this is what they're going to become specialty at or good at, as far as like drawing more out of tools than, you know, what's previously been shown, this is like a really compelling hunk of clay for them to work with, you know, if they, you know, believe in that operation going forward.
My reaction the last couple of days was a little bit of an eye roll when both Mark Feinsand and Scott Merkin of MLB.com, Merk, of course, friend of the show, covers the White Sox, saying that the White Sox are interested. And we're getting really close to the deadline for Murakami Monday. And I'm thinking, poor Murakami, like nobody is offering anything to him. It's been weeks and heavy analysis as far as all the metrics in Japan and raising all the red flags, especially, and we'll talk about those during this podcast, that if the White Sox could be, are they the last team? Are they the only team making an offer? And to your point, Jim, obviously they made this legit offer that they were comfortable in doing so, but it does make me wonder, let's say if Kylie McDaniel of ESPN was right in the pre-free agent opening, that Murakami could have gotten a 5-year, $80 million contract. This is a pretty steep step back for Murakami and for Murakami's agent and for the team that posted to go from an $80 million projected contract all the way down to $34 million. But for the White Sox, just like the MLB draft lottery, luck's on their side. The Pope might be having a hand in this. Everything seems to be coming up flowers right now in the city of Chicago for sports when it's been so decimated the last few years. Maybe it's turning around in the sports scene and a little luck for the White Sox that they get an opportunity to add a 70 grade or 80 grade power bat to their lineup, a lineup that is very hungry for more potential 30 plus home run type of hitters. And if everybody else in Major League Baseball is going to sit out and he's willing to come to the majors on this small of a deal, I think that's great for the White Sox.
And I think a lot of people saw it the same way. Like, I think the reaction from third parties who are either not invested in the White Sox or like to poke fun at them said like, oh, cool. Like, great. That's makes sense for them to do something like this because they need to be interesting. They have some young talent, may as well take a shot at making them more compelling. Also, like, if it goes as poorly as some of the numbers suggest, it's par for the course for the White Sox. Like, it's just another, another thing we can make fun of them about. But it is a, I think given his age, given that he'll be 26 in February. If it goes well enough, he'll re-enter free agency at 28, which is, perfectly fine, to get paid as a bat if you show major league, above averageness, which, I think predicting him for stardom, it seems like a stretch for anybody at this point, but just, he being somebody who homers enough to offset other flaws while playing a decent first base, like that's eminently reasonable outcome. So I think that the term of the deal makes sense for him just to, if he has concerns or if he knows that I have some adjustments ahead of me to, have to react to major league velocity or to cut down my strikeout rate or at least maintain my strikeout rate from one league to the other. He does get that kind of opportunity to struggle for a bit without costing anything, without like pressure mounting. It is like a good transition environment for him just to figure himself out as a major leaguer. And then like, if it goes, fantastically for him, like he can test the market once again without a posting fee, without doubts about how his bat's going to immediately carry over, whether there's going to be this big, ugly, jarring shift from one league to the other. Makes sense for him too. Like it's not the deal he wanted, but I think annually it's not that far off from some estimates. And it's better like 2 years than like say three or four in terms of being able to capitalize on his value should he hit.
I just think in another world, if another team had offered 5 years, $80 million, and then it got leaked that the White Sox offer to Murakami was only 2 years, $34 million, we would have made fun of the White Sox, be like, yep, see it at the table. Once again.
Yeah, it would have been like, Masahiro Tanaka all over again. The White Sox, really proud of themselves for a second place offer that had no chance of, no chance of connecting. I think Shohei Ohtani, they officially.
Did they even participate?
I think they did just because like it cost them nothing. But I think they also had like no chance in hell. Everybody knew it. But it was a case of it's basically.
They had a presentation that got like eliminated early on.
Got it.
Yeah. But I think they did participate and got the answer. But it is very much a case of like, hey, we're trying, we're pulling all the stops to get Shohei Ohtani. Like, no, there's nothing happening here. This is probably, that would have been the case if some team massively outbid him. But like, this is the opportunity I think Getz was talking about not wanting to, not seeing themselves making any huge outlays this time, but should the right opportunity tumble down to them for some reason, like they might have, and they're rolling like one of the lowest payrolls in baseball at this point, especially if like they trade Luis Roberts, like it's money coming in and money going out payroll later this winter. Like this surge in spending might only be limited if they ended up trading the guy who's making the most. So it's fun. Like it's Yeah, between the White Sox winning the number one overall pick in the lottery and this, I think it's probably the most fascinating month they could have in terms of just general league-wide or just casual White Sox fan interest.
The vibes are getting better. The vibes have been getting better since Pittsburgh, since the All-Star break, when they shocked us and they had that whole stretch that James mocked me for. When they're averaging 7.5, 8 runs a game and absolutely demolishing fastballs finally and playing more like a 70-win team in post-All-Star break than the team that was going to struggle to win 50 games again in the first half. The vibes have been good.
Now they got a guy who has a 30% miss rate on fastballs 94 and above. That'll
yeah, but he
amend
can
those
hit
issues
the ball.
Immediately. Forthwith.
He can hit the ball 490 feet, James. So what if he goes 4-for-20 at a stretch? If two of those four hits are home runs, heck yeah, right? That's all that matters in the end? That's what the White Sox are hoping for with Murakami?
I mean, they definitely need to bring something back to the right field that he can, like, hit home runs off of.
Sure. Well, so let's get into that. Let's break down Murakami's profile.
Some sort of target. I don't know.
The goose. Dust off the goose.
They do need something out there in the concourse. Even Colson McGovery could aim for it. So let's talk about Murakami's profile and, I guess, in a way, set expectations, but we're really not going to know on how Murakami is faring until regular season play. And that first introduction to Major League pitching maybe won't be really comfortable in our analysis until Memorial Day. So he's going to be learning. We're going to be learning from Murakami. The White Sox are going to be learning. But from a positive standpoint,
not a chance. This guy either like strikes out and looks awful or hits 500-foot home runs. There will be no rational reactions to either direction what he does from like the first week of Cactus League. Not a chance.
All right.
Live in the world that we're in.
Yeah, that is true. One of the things that did catch my eye, though, James, so talking about the positives, obviously the power. And on Fangraphs, you and Eric Loggenhagen, like, is this a potential of 80 grade power? Is that what you guys are talking about when you're writing up about the power and what you have heard from other scouts when it comes to Murakami?
No, like, it's actualized. Maybe the game power is like a 70 because of all the whiffs. But as far as like raw numbers, it's, I don't know if it's like Stanton, but I think we put it at like all the way up. So, like, it's not. I had a friend texting me like snarkily, they talked about him being Babe Ruth, but at that point in the video they show him like just hitting a single to the opposite field. It's like that's not gonna be the issue. Like, it's not like it's not gonna translate to the same ball or the same environment. Like, we have it as an 80. It's, I don't know if it's gonna be like at Stanton, but like it should be like in the top 5 percentile as far as like exit velocities in the sport, I would think.
Okay. The one number that
it's not the question mark.
The one number that caught my or metric that caught my attention though, James, is his walk rate. He has posted double digit percentage walk rates in Japan every year. A 14.3% walk rate from last year. So we'll talk about the contact issues in our next segment here about the red flags, but from a positive standpoint, I mean, he might be a low contact guy, but is there a chance that he could be a high OBP, like a 340 OBP, because he does have the ability to draw walks?
I mean, I think he's probably MVP if he has a 340 OBP or, you know, pretty dang good. It's more like average chase. He's not like a super great play distance guy. He'll definitely chase at the bottom of the zone a little bit, but it's not like a weakness. And just the level of power he produces and the way he gets pitched. And obviously the extreme level of punishment for leaving a mistake in the zone versus the high probability reward of getting him to chase. I think he's going to see a lot of efforts to pitch him out of the zone, try to get him to chase at spin. And, you know, his walk weight could be elevated both because he's probably baseline would be 7 or 8%, and he'll probably get pitched a little carefully unless he's just getting abused by four seamers in the zone in a way that simplifies the attacks against him. But I don't think it's going to I don't think he's going to have an above average OBP if he's hitting like 190 or 180. And if it's that level of like Joey Gallo production, I think it's more like be happy if he's got a 300 OBP. But it's not a negative in his profile. It's a slight positive. I would say that it's a little bit of a byproduct of his style of play, though.
So let's talk about some of the concerns. And Jim mentioned the big one, James, the contact rate of 73%. But on Fangraphs, and Ergun Loggenhagen wrote about this, the contact rate on fastball is greater than 93 miles per hour. So this is going to be one of those metrics that we're going to be paying attention to early. Last year, just 63% contact on fastballs greater than 93 miles per hour within the strike zone. And obviously that's a number that no major leaguer can live with, right? Like that's a number that we're going to need to see at least what, above 75%, closer to 80% if he's got a chance to stick.
I mean, he did slug pretty high, even with that high whiff rate on those. Like, so when he does connect, it's legit, but yeah, that'd be problematic. I mean, he didn't see a ton. That probably represents like 20% of the fastballs he faced in general.
Do we know what that average fastball velocity is in Japan? Because for right-handed pitchers of the major leagues now, it's greater than 94.
I think it's up to 95 for
majors now. Okay.
Yeah, for right-handers. Left-handers get away with less.
Yes, they do. I think it's like
Martin Perez is keeping them down.
Dragging it down. It's like 93 for lefties.
It's basically a long synergy search that's still loading, but I want to say he obviously sees a lot more like 90, 91 than okay. He's going to see here. It was 92. It's the average that he faced last year.
Got it. Okay, so with him coming out to the majors,
theoretically, he can get better with more exposure is what I'm saying. Like he's timed up for what he's seen a lot. So I think seeing 95 is more of a change of pace down there than it would be here. Is my optimistic spin on it. But yeah, that's part of why there's scouts who texted me who think he's just going to totally be a bust. He could just strike out way too much. Like it's really hard to produce around 40% strikeout rate. It's not about aesthetics, about the game being boring or how it looks being too many strikeouts. Like if you just have that few shots on goal, your hit rate kind of becomes irrelevant at a certain point.
No, and that makes sense. I think this would be a good question for the director of hitting for the White Sox, Ryan Fuller, of what is the plan of attack now that Murakami is part of the organization, work with Murakami, hopefully before he arrives to spring training. I assume Murakami is going to be part of Team Japan for the World Baseball Classic. He was in 2023, so he might not get that much time to work with White Sox coaches during spring training until the tail end of spring training. But what will the White Sox do to try to help Murakami when it comes to fastball velocity? But it does harken back to a criticism that even Jose Abreu faced, James, when Abreu signed with the White Sox. And even Shohei Ohtani got a little bit of this, too, when he signed with the Angels and it was getting his first exposure against Major League Pitching. It seems like for a lot of hitters outside of the United States who don't play college baseball or maybe elite high school baseball, there seems to be a concern about this particular batter against fastballs. And in Abreu's case, it was, can he hit the inside fastball? And Abreu showed right away in that first month he can, as he hit 10 home runs in his first month of the major leagues on his way to win rookie
year. He went through a pretty significant swing change right before he came over to the majors.
So is that a possibility? Is that one of the unknowns that we don't know until you arrive in Arizona for the start of spring training and get a chance to talk to everyone?
It could be, but it'd be individual to Murakami. I couldn't say that like he necessarily profiles for what Abreu profiled for at the time, as far as like something to change. So like Abreu didn't just switch from the wrong swing to the right swing, and you know, Murakami has to look that up and do it himself. It depends if like that kind of the physical ability to, you know, tuck his hands in the way Brady got pretty good at for inside fastballs is there for him.
because the reason I bring this point up, Jim, is that, yeah, the metrics are scary, but this is based on the way that Murakami swung against Japanese pitchers since he was 19 years old, from age 19 to age 25 this past season. So I think we have to kind of leave the door open of him making an adjustment, not to completely toss these numbers away, but the White Sox continue to point out, yes, these are bad things, but these are things that don't crush us. They're opportunities for us to get better. And maybe that's kind of how everyone, at least I view it from a White Sox perspective, from Murakami, is that we should maybe leave the door open that there is an opportunity that Murakami, working with White Sox coaches, maybe arriving in Arizona earlier to work with Ryan Fuller, that Murakami can make the necessary adjustments to improve that contact rate, especially against high velocity.
Yeah, you hear it a lot with prospects, especially ones who like cruise to the lower minors and then struggle. We heard just like most recently with Colson saying like, oh, it's good that he struggled. You know, he's always been able to be the best player on the field every level he's played. You know, he's never had to encounter struggles. It'll be valuable for him down the road to encounter this and you know, see how he rebounds and learn something about himself as well. And I think, you know, sometimes that's cover for like, we don't know how else to talk about this. We're not intending him to struggle. Oh, no. Yeah. Like, you know, how do we present a public face, a public reaction to this? But also, I think there is truth to it. You know, you succeed being the way you are for a long time. And then there's that final mile to close of like, okay, now what worked for me in Japan doesn't work for me in the majors. But yeah, obviously if you have 56, if you set the single season home run record in Japan, if you have a 4-digit OPS, must be doing something right. Or there must be something in there that is not just, you know, you'd hope just beating up on, a supply of below average velocity fastballs when they, you know, inevitably have to come back into the zone for you. Yeah, I mean, I just keep coming back to the word fascinating. Like, it's just, it's a bold experiment. And like, it does test the White Sox hitting infrastructure in a way that, you know, it's a bold investment and it kind of puts them out there a little bit. But also, you know, we're thinking about like, if the White Sox signed Ryan O'Hearn to this deal, you know, they're hoping that O'Hearn holds ground, that he doesn't decline in his 30s. You know, he was very much a disappointment until he went to Baltimore and worked with Ryan Fuller. And like, he's probably the most visible feather in Fuller's cap in terms of turning nothing into something and in something quite valuable in the right situations. So like, you know, while, you know, Murakami, what he's earning is, you know, not a reclamation project exactly. It is the same kind of buy low opportunity, or we see something and we have the opportunity to get him right. Like, you know, like the way Baltimore had playing time and they had a way to, you know, minimize his weaknesses. Like, the White Sox can do the same. Like, they can start him every day. They can start him against righties. They can, you know, rotate him in and out with other players if need be. Like, they have ways to mitigate it to avoid just exposing him to all the elements and hoping he survives. So looking forward to seeing how the White Sox respond. Looking forward to like their initial observations or tweaks if they have them. I'm looking forward to seeing if they don't have any initial tweaks. If they want to see how it plays against major league pitching in spring training, or against me, you know, real velocity in spring training and making adjustments as they go. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing the talent he has as a hitter, and does he have the ability to adjust? Like, this is, if the White Sox signed O'Hearn, like, it'd be cool. Like, it would improve the floor of talent on the roster, but yeah, you know what you're getting. This is a case where like, yeah, it could be a disaster, but it also could be, you know, the White Sox are no stranger to some hard earned success, like success that doesn't, you know, arrive immediately, but eventually they get there. And this could be another case to where like they do turn him into something. You know, if he doesn't immediately experience success on his own talent, you know, there might be ways to get there. And I'm looking forward, you know, given the investment, I imagine they do have some plan B's and C's in mind, based on what he's seeing and what he's showing.
Take a look at Steamer's projections, which you can check out from Murakami on Fangraphs.com. Steamer, 122 games, 24 home runs, 64 RBIs, a .227 batting average, a .330 on base percentage, .438 slugging, a .112 weighted runs created plus, so that's 12% better than league average, 1.7 WAR with a 29% strikeout rate and a 12.6% walk rate. James Fegan, if Steamer is right, and at the end of September in 2026, Murakami plays 122 games and hits 24 home runs and boasts those types of numbers and is above league average hitter and he's 1.7 at first base for WAR, are the White Sox happy with that?
Yeah, that's fine. That's a solid player. It's unspectacular. I think the defense probably makes you a little not like super eager to get back on at the end of the 2 years. But as far as meeting the value of the deal, helping the team, it's a guy you'd put out there every day. Does the 1.7 speak to the defense being a big negative and thus he kind of transitions to DH? Or needs to, because you obviously have a lot of people who need that DH slot. It's kind of weird, given that he's such an extreme profile, that the projection spits out like something that's like middle of the road on everything, including like his strikeout thing, like weirdly okay. It's I don't know what that season line would look like to watch, but in a vacuum, like, yeah, that's fine. It's a slightly above average first baseman that they got for, I guess, a slightly above average like outlay. That sounds like a fair deal. You shake hands and walk away from it, maybe not remember it super strongly in 5-10 years, but it went fine.
Kind of strikes me as like Gavin Sheets's best foot forward, like that kind of production. Like strikeout rate is different, but in terms of the just above average bats, has the size of a first baseman, doesn't leverage it particularly well. Like, yeah, it's, you know, he was fine. You know, he's fine for the Padres, he's fine in doses for the White Sox, and just BK. So yeah, just it's you know, they ended up back at Gavin Sheets. All roads lead back to Gavin Sheets, basically, would be the takeaway from it. But still, I think it's more about the journey than the destination here, given the White Sox projected win totals overall.
Gavin Sheets is way too iron constitution to be limited to 122 games.
Man, never breaks down.
Yeah.
No matter how many times he tumbles in the outfield.
He can take a punch.
So Murakami now in the fold, and the White Sox are planning for Murakami to play first base, which means that more than likely Miguel Vargas, majority play time for Vargas in 2026, will be over at third base. So your projected infield right now in late December, Murakami at first, Chase Mydrott at second, Colson Montgomery at short, Miguel Vargas at third base. It's not a bad infield. It's not the best in Major League Baseball, but it's got potential to be better than what the projections say on paper, at least, that there is somewhat of a ceiling within this White Sox infield. But it does raise the question, James, of what does this mean for guys like Lenin Sosa and Curtis Mead and Brian Ramos in the infield? They're all out of options. And we even heard it in Orlando during the winter meetings. I don't know if anyone has a good answer of what to do with Lenin Sosa after he led the White Sox in home runs in 2025, and what is his most clear path forward. We're joking on social media that maybe Lenin Sosa should grab an outfielder's glove. And we even talked about it in one of our previous episodes of the Sox Machine podcast. Let's get ready for the Lenin Sosa outfield experience. But with your expertise, what does this mean for Sosa, Mead, and Ramos?
I don't like the Sosa outfield idea. I don't know. Lenin Sosa defensive experiment seems like an interesting term. Theoretically, you have kind of this solid bat that you are okay with mixing at first, okay with playing at second sometimes. You know, Mydroth is a solid part of the group, but maybe not someone you feel like you need to give 700 PAs to, and he can't take a day off, or can't. And also, like, if anybody goes down, like if Vargas gets hurt, you shift Colson to the third base and Bydrop to short, and Lenny plays some second base for a while or something like that. Having one more bat than you absolutely need, or that you feel good about, I think there's a spot for someone on that team, and that player plays a decent amount. As far as like three other guys who are all in the same out of option situation, and one Ramos was like just not even really getting in the rotation of getting regular use his last time up, and wasn't necessarily setting triple on fire A on fire in a way that would demand it. I think the path gets most complicated for him. He's also probably the one who's at least toyed with like starting the outfield before, and probably with their athletic profiles would be the best candidate for it. But yeah, I think him and Mead are kind of up against it going into spring with the way things are currently outlined. Like, injury could open up really easily, or maybe we're in March and like Mead has 1100 OPS in spring and we can't even remember when we didn't see him as an essential part of the group or something like that. But at this point, at this juncture, you'd probably say like, it seems like they have to figure out getting value for Ramos and Mead, or just like losing at the end of spring training with the way the roster currently sits. But I don't think, outside of someone like Murakami and outside of like someone even like Colson Montgomery, like there's just not anyone that infield mix who's like, this is their position. You're never moving them off. You can't even like compete with them with, if you like outplay them in spring training. So I think there's room for it to move, even if it's what it currently lays at.
And to that point, Jim, I agree with James. Like, I do foresee now Lenin Sosa being that super utility infielder, maybe the first guy coming off the bench, especially in games like, you know, the White Sox are going to have to, they did their best and the Tigers helped out at times to avoid facing Tarik Skubal. But if Skubal is facing the White Sox, maybe that's an opportunity to move Mydroth over to short. Sosa could play either second or first, get the left-handed bats a day off from facing Skubal. I like that Sosa could be that super utility guy. You still need league average bats, even on the bench. But I don't think this is good news for Curtis Mead or Brian Ramos.
I would say Sosa's more utility guy than super utility guy. Like, I don't think there's anything super about his defensive profile, but he, like, you can...
No.
You can have him...
He's a league average bat, though.
Yeah, you can have him stand in different places and not feel bad about it for more than a game at a time. And, like, if he makes just an infuriating decision, I think everybody is probably possesses some capability of laughing at it or knowing what they're getting, or just being like, you know, shrug emojis all around. So, yeah, I think Sosa fits in. Also, like, I have the kind of theory that he elevates his game to never be, like, the worst option, which makes me think, like, you know, that either he's going to continue to improve in a way that kind of just annoys the White Sox front office. Like, who will rid us of this meddling Sosa who just, like, constantly hits too well to bench, but also doesn't play anything well enough to like feel secure about. And like, he's just always dangling. He's like a floater in their long-term vision. Like, I can't see where is this guy? Like, why he doesn't fit neatly anywhere, but we also can't give him up for nothing. So I predict like a little bit more improvement offensively for him in a way that frustrates the White Sox ability to just like decide on him once and for all. I'm, you know, with Mead and yeah, especially Ramos, I think like, I wonder if there's ability to like sneak him through waivers at the end of the spring. Like, I think Ramos, especially if he doesn't make any strides, like if he somehow does capture the form they did a couple of years ago, where like he's got the ability to cover east, west of the strike zone a little bit. And he's not terrible in the outfield in the looks that they give him. Like, perhaps he gets claimed, but I think with the way his stock is kind of stagnated, I think there's just like a lot of guys who are like him in the majors and who may also be facing that same bubble situation, to where at the end of spring, they're all kind of jettisoned and looking for new homes. And I can't imagine all of them will be claimed. So I think, you know, there is a case of, you know, Ramos just like taking your shot, like maybe not having to trade him, seeing if he gets through. If he gets claimed, so be it. But you're kind of secretly hoping that you just get like 3 more months in Charlotte to see if he can have him improve in the outfield, or see if like they have one more solution for him. But yeah, otherwise, I think kind of it takes care of itself. I think even like with Mead before this edition, they were not all that enamored with what they saw, to where like they have to make the Adrian Hauser trade work. They have to, you know, get value for it. I guess they predicted Duncan Davitt at the 40-man deadline, so perhaps that's whose basket they're putting the eggs in when it comes to getting a return for that deal. But yeah, I would say like kind of, you know, Vargas was going to be between third and first. Now this puts him at third. You know, Sosa was going to be kind of first in DH, and now this puts him at like a platoon first. So like, I think it naturally sorts itself out right now. And it's just more of a matter of, should the contact issues for Murakami and Colson flare up in a way that makes them tough to play? What do you do then? What's the best production versus defense balance? I think it gets a lot trickier right now. I think even though the defense might be a little bit wobbly at the corners, and you know, you're still hoping that Colson maintains what he showed last year at shortstop, you have a reason to be playing all four guys at all four positions, and understanding why you're doing it, even if there might be like a bad defensive game here and there. But I think, you know, should the order gets thrown askew for a bit, that's I think where all right, Will Venable's job, it gets a lot tougher figuring out what's my best defense and can they hit it all, and what's my best offense and are we making life hell on our ground ballers.
It'd be nice if they had more strikeout pitchers. Maybe they're coming in Hagen Smith and Noah Schultz later in 2026. But another aspect to pay attention to early in the season with the current projected starting rotation for the White Sox. But this offseason's not done yet, and they still have some items on the shopping list. And we continue to play this game of trying to guess what's next for the Chicago White Sox. And then immediately, I think it was Bob Nightingale who tweeted that the White Sox are still willing to trade Luis Robert Jr. and mention the New York Mets and the Cincinnati Reds as possible suitors. And James, to be a meatball fan for a moment, after signing Murakami, I want to see at the beginning of the season how this looks for the White Sox with Luis Robert Jr. on hand. I am now pivoting to where, sure, I'm open to the idea of the White Sox possibly trading Luis Robert Jr., as I'm curious in what they could possibly get back for Robert, despite all of the quotes and the positivity that Chris Getz feels about Luis Robert and how much he values Luis Robert being part of the White Sox organization and is expecting Luis Robert to be his opening day center fielder. We still read and hear that the gossip out there is that the White Sox are willing to trade Luis Robert Jr. And being a meatball, I don't want to see it, James. I don't want to see the White Sox trade Luis Robert after signing Murakami. I want to see what this looks like for a potential White Sox offense, at least through June, before they decide whether or not they are serious about trading Luis Robert.
Okay, I understand your position.
Thank you. Jim, does that make sense? Not wanting the White Sox to trade Luis Robert?
I think it's, you know, with Murakami aboard, with Robert, like I think the argument is we may as well capture the highest possible upside starting nine that we possibly have. Like, you know, if we put a whole bunch of bottles out and we get lightning in enough of them, you know, what will this lineup look like, or what will the defense look like? So yeah, I get it. It's just a matter of, you know, if Robert plays 60 games again, because just another lower body issue undermines him. And then what was it all for? So I think, you know, those are the two arguments, to put your words, the meatball argument of let's make one more run at it, one more job, or is it a case of now is a case where we are trying to shape our roster up into a more, just more credible starting nine, and we can't waste another year having Robert being the center field option who's not there for 3 months of the year, and what it's down to Brooks Baldwin. So like, yeah, I could see arguments both ways. turning the page on it and being like, okay, this is, we're now have our core, and then whatever Murakami turns out to be and whatever we get for Robert is the best option. I can see the White Sox looking at it both ways. But it does seem like, you know, if they still want to patch up like right field, or if they still want to add starters, or they still want to add like at least one sturdy reliever. And I guess we'll find out, you know, or maybe the White Sox or Chris Getz will offer some hints in terms of what they're actually able to spend. Does adding a Murakami necessitate trading a Robert in order to still make the additions they want to make, given that nobody is necessarily anticipating a $17 million salary or like a $20 million salary when including the release fee that was paid? Like, is this a case where they saw an opportunity to add and couldn't resist it, or they add but they have to subtract in order to accommodate it?
I think that is a good question, James. Do you have any insight on that particular point that Jim made?
I mean, I think it certainly affects the level of which they can go about the rest of their offseason. So trading Robert allows you to maybe be more aggressive with what you're going to do for adding another starting pitcher. If you want to get one of those mid-tier guys and you just, you know, spent 17 per on Murakami, or if you're have your sights fit on like maybe more legit right fielder rather than like a platoon of guys making $2 million, like Robert can free that up. So they've taken this upside swing here, which obviously whatever you do land them, but what does it necessarily fit? How does it fit on the next like contending White Sox team would be possibly a question. And how soon do you expect that to be? And is Robert, you know,
give us a timetable, damn it.
If Robert's kind of getting traded because he doesn't fit in it, then he has this year and next year a team control, how does Murakami move the picture forward is maybe something to reconcile. But I think, yeah, there's a question of how they want to go about this budget-wise with the remaining needs they have.
But this is where I agree with the Sox Machine commenters, though. If now, after signing Murakami, that if you still wanted to sign like a Peter Fairbanks, for example, or a mid-tier starting pitcher, but the only way I could accomplish that now, if I was Chris Getz, is that I have to trade Luis Robert, I guess in hindsight, why did you pick up the option? Back then, you were totally cool with him being your center fielder.
You thought you could trade it at all, which is the main reason to not do it, is if you just think you're stuck with it and he'll never produce up to the level. But if the market's dictating that it's tradable, then that would be self-justifying to you for why you picked up the option.
I guess the good news for Getz is that before we started to record, Wilson Contreras of the St. Louis Cardinals got traded to the Boston Red Sox, Jim. And the three players going back to St. Louis, I think only one is in the top 30 prospects for the Boston Red Sox. So that was like a pure salary.
Please put respect on Yoker Fryer's name, Josh Nelson.
Well, he didn't make the Red Sox top 30. I don't know if he'd be in the White Sox top 30, but it's not that impressive.
Maybe he should be, is what some people might contend.
Okay, sure. So St. Louis, that's a salary dump for the Cardinals, and everybody knows that's what St. Louis is trying to do. They're still trying to trade Brendan Donovan and hopefully Nolan Arenado that they want to accomplish this offseason. It's just, I know it's meatballish, and I can understand from a very logical reason that when we picked up the option, Josh, we had no idea that we could be serious suitors for Murakami. But now here we are in late December. The center field market sucked to begin with. This offseason, it's not going to get better. There are teams that clearly want to upgrade their outfield. We saw Philadelphia sign Adolis Garcia to be part of their outfield, and they seem pretty set, and there's just very limited options. So if the Mets and Reds call and they give us an attractive package, maybe we get a AAA starting pitcher out of the deal with Luis Robert that we can maybe plug and play into our starting rotation. I use that $20 million that I save. We go get Peter Fairbanks. Maybe we bring back Mike Tauchman to help solidify right field. That might be a better allocation of assets that I did not know that this opportunity presented itself in December, Josh. So stop being a meatball. Things could change during the offseason. But damn it, Jim, I still want to see how this looks. And if Luis Robert can bounce back to his 2023 self, still have that naive hope, it would be a lot of fun to start the season if Murakami and Kosta Montgomery and Luis Robert start the season hot. It could be fun being a White Sox fan.
I'm looking forward to seeing like the Pecota spread, especially if the White Sox keep Robert somehow over the course of the winter. Like Pecota projections along with just having the overall projection of what the White Sox predicted record will be. They have this spread of outcomes that shows like how variant a team can possibly be based on who stays healthy, the combination of players who meet their 80th percentile outcomes in a given simulation. Like I could see the White Sox having a pretty wild spread, like with the talent on hand and with the power they've shown and also with the flaws they've shown, being like, this team's going to win, somehow win 87 games. This team is going to struggle to win 55. Like I could see it being, both cases, and
wide spread.
Yeah. But the fact that we've gotten 143 comments on a post in December, when, especially after the Bears just took all the headlines for beating the Packers, when it should be like
all the right reasons, though.
Yeah,
all
when it should right be reasons. Thoroughly Chicago Bears season, and there should be no oxygen for the White Sox to make news. Like, it's fun to have you know, this kind of move and. Now having these questions about like, do they keep Robert? Do they trade him? What are your ambitions? Like this does paint a more evocative picture of like what the White Sox actually intend to accomplish over the next couple of years, assuming like no labor stoppage really you know, takes a bite out of 2027.
We'll learn more as Murakami will be introduced to the Chicago media and White Sox fans on Monday morning at 11 a.m. Central Time at Wright Field. James Fegan will be there representing us at Sox Machine. You can watch that stream on CHSN, the Chicago Sports Network. And be curious to see what Getz has as far as answers to those questions. No doubt, maybe... a veteran reporter will once again grill accidentally Chris Getz. Be like, man, this is like the best thing that's ever happened during your GM tenure. We'll see what Bruce Levine asks Chris Getz on Monday morning. But again, we'll have that coverage for you guys on SoxMachine.com.
It'd be great if he's like, now you've got two good things. How about that?
Now you got two good things.
Just continue, lean into the bit. You're on a roll, Chris.
That will do.
Three's a trend. Maybe that's how he says it. Like, it's only two.
Yeah. Well, that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen to the show and watch our videos on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. For all of our new, hopefully subscribers, but at least followers from Japan, hello. You can follow us on social media. We're at Sox Machine. You can follow James Fegan at JR Fegan. You can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. And if you're not a subscriber, you can become one at SoxMachine.com/products, where monthly plans start at $5 and you get discounts on an annual subscription. It unlocks all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, and also our comment section. We have additional tiers of support for our 10 war and higher subscribers. We just answered a bunch of your guys' questions in a PO Sox mailbag, some questions about the MLB draft that all three of us chimed in about. And on Monday nights, we're going to be meeting up with our 25 war and higher subscribers in a Zoom call, and I'm sure they're gonna have a lot of questions about Murakami.
Yeah, well timed
press conference and what is next for the White Sox. So if you want that additional access to Sox Machine and additional content, go to SoxMachine.com/products and sign up today. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com, part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside Jim Margulis and James Fegan, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.